The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even though our charge is to ensure that policing is constitutional and lawful, we're here to tell you that you need to do more than just tell your officers to abide by the law. Because if that's all you're telling them to do, it leaves the door open for a lot of harmful behavior and a lot of behavior that will cross that line from legal to illegal.
I'm Tyler McBrien, Managing Editor of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 4th, 2023. On July 27th, the Justice Department announced a sprawling civil rights investigation, known as a pattern or practice investigation, into the city of Memphis and the Memphis Police Department. The announcement came just weeks after the department's civil rights division released a report of a similar investigation into abuses at the Minneapolis Police Department. Both investigations were motivated, at least in part, by the murder of black men at the hands of police, Tyree Nichols in Memphis and George Floyd in Minneapolis. In a recent article for Lawfare about the Minneapolis report, in another report looking at the Louisville Metro Police Department, Christy Lopez wrote, "As with past police investigations, the abuse these reports document is chilling, partly in its frequency, and perhaps even more so in conveying how casually abuse can occur in policing." And yet she remained hopeful, writing that the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, quote, "heralded what could be a new era in police reform." I sat down with Christy, a professor from practice at Georgetown Law, and former deputy chief in the special litigation section of the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department, to talk about her extensive experience conducting pattern or practice investigations into police departments and negotiating consent decrees. She spoke with me about the history of these investigations stretching back to the Rodney King beating, the common trends of police abuse that pattern or practice investigations find, and whether or not we're in the midst of a broader reckoning with ideas of policing and public safety. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 4th. A new era in police reform with Christy Lopez. So, Christy, I wanted to start with the most recent news, the announcement from the Justice Department that it has opened a civil pattern or practice investigation to the city of Memphis and the Memphis Police Department. So first, I just wanted to get our listeners on the same page. Could you remind us what motivated this announcement? I'm speaking particularly of the case of Tyree Nichols.
I do think it's fair to say that this investigation would not have been launched if Tyree Nichols had not been killed by members of Memphis PD's Scorpion unit, although the timing of the announcement indicates that it's not as direct a response as we've seen in some other cases. But certainly that is a case where it was a beating death caused by Memphis PD, and for many of us who have been doing this work for quite a long time, one of the things that made it really chilling was how similar it was to the types of abusive practices we have seen from similar units for decades now, perhaps made more salient for people and more obvious to people because of the availability of video recordings. But Tyree Nichols was stopped by members of the Scorpion unit purportedly for reckless driving, although the department tells us they haven't been able to confirm that he was in fact driving recklessly. He initially tries to ask some questions about why he's being stopped, is clearly afraid. He runs from the vehicle. They chase him. Before he runs, they pepper spray him. He runs from the vehicle. He's not very far from his home. He appears to be running home. And officers eventually catch up with him near to where he lives. And just begin beating him brutally. You hear Tyree Nichols screaming for his mother, apparently hoping that she'll come to the scene. He's very near his home at that point. The officers continue to beat him. The beating is caught on video footage, both on the officers' body-worn cameras, as well as some pole cameras that are nearby. And then you watch as Tyree Nichols loses consciousness. He's leaned up against the car, the patrol car, and officers take pictures of Tyree Nichols and circulate them. One officer does. But there's no apparent attempt to provide him medical care. Eventually, other officers from other agencies come on scene. EMTs come on scene. Eventually, he is provided some medical care and transported to a hospital where he dies a few days later.
Thank you for setting that up. I know it's difficult to hear and to recount, but so important to, you know, establish the stakes and the prevalence of these incidents, I think, at the outset. I think it's an amazing opportunity to speak to you with someone with such intimate knowledge of these pattern or practice investigations. So I would also first like to set the scene of what are these investigations? We've heard them a few times now, especially with greater frequency in the Biden administration. But what does this term mean, pattern or practice investigation?
A pattern or practice investigation by the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division is an investigation that focuses on the entire police agency, sometimes a unit within the agency, but quite often, as here, it focuses on the entire agency rather than just one officer. The division also has a criminal section that will at times criminally prosecute individual officers. And certainly private plaintiffs can bring lawsuits, civil lawsuits against individual officers, as Tyree Nichols' family is doing here. It's more difficult for private plaintiffs to bring lawsuits against an entire city police department, and more difficult still to do what the Department of Justice can do through these pattern or practice investigations, which is obtain what they call injunctive relief if they demonstrate that there is, in fact, a pattern or practice of constitutional violations or violations of federal statutory rights. And injunctive relief allows you to obtain a remedy that's not simply money, which of course can be important to compensate people for their losses. But injunctive relief is really forward-looking and seeks to change the practices and the policies of the agency to change how its police officers conduct themselves going forward.
And what's the typical timeline look like? I know in the case of the announcement of the pattern or practice investigation into the Memphis Police Department, as part of the announcement, the Justice Department mentioned, for example, they conducted an initial review. So would you be able to walk us from the beginning stages, you know, into the meat of it? And then what is then the result of these investigations in terms of a report and, you know, especially the negotiation of a consent decree?
The timeline for what I'm about to set out really varies. The shortest investigation I'm aware of was our investigation of the Ferguson Police Department, which took 6 months. Some investigations can take years. Most of them during the Obama administration were kept at about 1 year. More recently, the investigations we saw of Louisville and of Minneapolis were closer to two. But that can vary for a lot of reasons, the complexity of the issue, the size of the department, as well as just the available resources for the Department of Justice. Essentially, the way that an investigation will start is with what they call preliminary inquiry. The department obtains information, you know, alleging violations of individuals' constitutional rights. They may receive that information in the form of a series of investigative reports through, you know, newspapers or magazines. They may receive a complaint from a advocacy organization that compiles individual stories of what they've experienced. Or it may be something like this, where their attention is focused on an agency. Their attention may have already been focused on Memphis for any number of reasons, but oftentimes what brings a department to the attention of the Civil Rights Division is an incident like Tyree Nichols' beating death. And once they have that information, they will, you know, there are a lot of different departments that they're probably looking at the same time, and they will be looking at whether there appears to be a pattern or a practice of violations. Is this just a one-off thing, an aberrational unit or an officer, or is this really something that looks like it's pervasive throughout the department? based on a lot of criteria that really go to sort of how the department wants to use its limited resources, the Civil Rights Division may decide to try to seek to open a actual formal investigation of the agency based on what the preliminary inquiry showed them. And if they do, you'll have an announcement akin to what we saw Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark provide the other day, where they formally announced to the public that this investigation is ongoing. They will generally talk with the city leadership right before, and then right before that announcement, and then the investigation is launched. They'll bring in a number of investigators, experts in police practices, statisticians, data scientists, and they will look at all the areas that they've set out. Here, they've set out stop searches and arrest, excessive force, and racially discriminatory policing. That's the process that can take a really long time. They also, of course, talk to people in that area. They've already held, in this case, they already held a community meeting via Zoom, I believe, last night. So they're already beginning that process, and they've already been on the ground meeting with people as well. That can take a long time, and you can turn over every stone. But they try to do enough investigation so they're certain that there really is a pattern of violations, and as importantly, that they understand the root causes of that so that they can develop appropriate remedies. They will then draft a findings report, which can also take a long time. And then when that findings report is completed and approved within the department, they'll have a public announcement of that. And that is where you will see the investigation go one of two ways. Either the jurisdiction will agree to cooperate with the Department of Justice and negotiate a consent decree, or the jurisdiction will not agree. And the Department of Justice at that point has the option of filing a civil lawsuit against the agency. Almost every case, the jurisdiction agrees to negotiate a decree. That process can take another 6 months to a year. And at the end of that, the parties have a consent decree that they file in court. There's an opportunity for the public to be heard, sometimes called a fairness hearing. And if the judge finds that everything is above board and is satisfied with the decree, the judge will enter that decree as a court order. And then the very long process of implementing that consent decree will ensue.
Yeah, I think it occurs to me that the scale of, or the scope rather, of these investigations and what they are setting out to try to prove that there is a pattern or practice of abuse really, really gets at this sort of bad apple defense that we so often hear when news breaks. And just to dwell on the process there, so when the public hears about these investigations, they often are attached with the word sweeping. So there's a sense of this great scale, and then the reports come out and they are can be lengthy, and I think for good reason. You want to marshal as much evidence as possible to make your case. Could you give the listeners a sense of this scale in terms of resources that go into these investigations, of personnel? The time itself can be longer, but just how much resources goes into these investigations?
These investigations are really resource intensive because, as you noted, this is not an investigation of a single officer or a single incident, usually not even an investigation of a single unit. They're an investigation of an entire department, and they're an investigation of many practices, usually many practices within that department. And you don't really have this, not a particularly large staff within the special litigation section, which is the section in the Civil Rights Division that does this work. And so I believe when I was there, the Chicago investigation was the largest team I was on. And I think we had about maybe 10 people, which was pretty large. Internally, and that's include the attorneys, our outreach specialists, our paralegals and investigators, interns, like everybody. And then we had a number of outside experts. Most investigations, at least when I was there, and I don't have any reason to believe it's different now, are closer to a team of 4 to 5 individuals on it, working on that, plus other cases as well. And so you really do rely a lot on the experts that you bring in. Every attorney in this section is an expert to some extent, or quickly will be, in police practices. But they bring in individuals with that expertise. And like I said, people who can crunch the numbers for them, teams of people that may include statisticians, economists, you know, all sorts of people who can sort of really help them make sense, especially now, of especially in a case that involves stop searches and arrests. You know, what are we seeing in these numbers? What might be thousands and thousands of stops and searches that they're evaluating? I mean, that's why it really can take so much time to really get the, a lot of the effort goes into actually obtaining the, can go into obtaining the information from the jurisdiction. It may not have the information in sort of usable format. We had situations, for example, we had to actually pay a vendor to get them to release the information to us because they wouldn't release it to the agency because the agency hadn't paid their bills. There's all sorts of obstacles that can crop up, and even trying to get the information to evaluate. And then you have to spend a considerable amount of time reviewing the information, analyzing it and writing up your findings. And that's in addition to the on the ground work of going on ride alongs with officers, talking with community members, walking through neighborhoods and seeing, you know, what people's experiences have been. It's not at all just a paper review, but there is a lot of analysis of data accompanied by a real qualitative assessment of on-the-ground conditions.
You spoke of some obstacles just now, and I think an assumption might be that police departments would be extremely resistant to these types of inquiries or investigations. What has your experience been in sort of the cooperativeness or not of police departments during a pattern or practice investigation?
My experience has been that there is a spectrum of cooperation from department to department, and there's a spectrum of cooperation within each department. Some departments will actually, they have asked you to come in and conduct an investigation, perhaps openly, perhaps not. Other departments really don't want you to come in, but they've made the political calculus that it's better to cooperate with you than not. And then other departments will fight you tooth and nail all the way. And Sheriff Joe Arpaio from Maricopa County is a pretty prominent example of that end of the spectrum. Within each department, were always people, regardless of the views of the leadership of the department, we always found people who were so happy to see us there and had been waiting for something like this to happen. And we always saw people who were furious that we were there. And, you know, it was going to take, you know, a order of the court to get them to even talk to you. So it really, really varies. Generally speaking, there is more cooperation than one might expect. I did civil litigation for a number of years, and I definitely was able to get more information through our pattern of practice investigations, where we don't even have subpoena power, than I was ever able to get in the course of civil litigation through normal discovery. So whether because they feel like they have to cooperate or they actually want to cooperate, there is a fair amount of, you know, resigned, you know, or enthusiastic cooperation from jurisdictions.
You recently wrote a piece in Lawfare just in early July on the heels of the report that came out of the investigation to the Minneapolis Police Department. Is an incredibly useful piece. I encourage all listeners to read it. It's called Justice Department Report Reflects Shift in Thinking About Police Reform. And one of the reasons I found it so useful was that you trace a bit of history and a bit of difference between administrations, especially focusing on the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations and sort of their different uses or lack of use in the Trump administration's case of these types of administrations. But I want to go back to the beginning, if you'd indulge me in a bit of a history lesson in terms of the history of the statute that lends authority to these investigations, and when was the first pattern or practice investigation, and what did it look into?
That's a great question. The statute was passed in 1994, and it was pretty dormant for a bit. No one really knew what to do with it. There was even some hesitation. They didn't know where to put it even, and they gave it to the special litigation section, largely because it had the authority to conduct pattern or practice investigations of jails and prisons under a statute called CRIPA. And there were, someone noticed at some point that nothing was really being done with this. And I'm not entirely sure what the kerfuffle was, but I do know that a number of investigations were opened on a single day and not much came of those investigations. So I'm not sure technically what the first investigation was, but the first real investigation was the investigation of the Pittsburgh Police Department, which I believe would have been 1995. And that did result in a consent decree. And if you go back and look at it, it's very basic, you know, exactly what you would expect. You know, you need better policies and training and oversight and uses of force. And I think it was force focused. Not not a lot of recognition of or emphasis on how interconnected police practices and management practices are. So the role of performance evaluations and promotions and of having different units available to respond, that was not part of those very early investigations. And then through the course of that was the Clinton era, those investigations started to slowly become a little bit more sophisticated. But what I saw then over the years and tried to capture a little bit in my piece for Lawfare was that in each administration that's trying anyway, you see sort of a new sort of growth spurt as they've learned from what's come before.
And just I think an interesting fact that I learned in preparing for this conversation was that, and correct me if I'm wrong, or rather correct Ryan Riley in the Huffington Post if he's wrong, that you actually joined the Justice Department around when the statute was passed and around when these pattern of practice investigations first started. So it's interesting, like, tracing your career and the evolution of these investigations.
Yeah, it has been sort of interesting to me. When I accepted the job, I was a baby attorney. I came in through the honors program just out of a clerkship after law school. And when I accepted the job, I don't believe that the section even had the authority, this pattern of practice police investigation authority. I wanted to go there to do their prison and jail work. I was really into international human rights at the time, but I really liked the domestic court system. And so the idea of sort of really advocating for individuals' fundamental rights, but having the U.S. courts at your, you know, available to you was really exciting to me. And so actually when I went to DOJ, I initially really focused on the prison and jail work, but you pretty quickly learn doing that work that most of the people in prisons and jails shouldn't be there. And I naturally just sort of started to go upstream a bit and think more about policing and how they got there. And so, you know, lucky for me, we had the statute that allowed me to really look into that and try to see what was happening, how the police were treating people. And so, my career has very much run on a parallel to the development of the enforcement of that statute.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed
from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
I think lucky for you, and also lucky for many people, that you started looking upstream. I want to fast forward a bit to your experience in leading the Ferguson pattern of practice investigation. Could you speak a bit about that experience, what you found and what your team found? And then especially I'm interested in you know, what has happened in Ferguson since the report was released and the consent decree was negotiated and agreed upon.
Yeah, so Ferguson was a really profound experience for me, because I had been investigating a lot of agencies where they actually had legitimate challenges with public safety, New Orleans and Newark. You know, other places where they were trying to fight crime, and there are some tensions that get introduced and some difficulties that get introduced that in no way excuse the civil rights violations that were occurring. But it was easier for me to see how that could occur. When we got to Ferguson, and it became very quickly apparent that they were using policing for something that had very little to do with public safety. It had a lot to do with two things. One was the collection of revenue and really sort of supporting the city's budget on the backs of poor people and mostly Black people. And also they were using policing to enforce a racialized social order. Ferguson had gone from majority white to majority Black in a relatively short time span. And that scared a lot of people, worried a lot of people. And they really saw the police as the way to keep people in line, to teach them how it's done here, how you're supposed to behave. And those two goals dovetailed in a really terrible, terrible way, so that they had all of these rules, you know, don't cross the street at right angles. You got to keep your lawn at this height. You've got to we have these occupancy permits. You have to tell us not only how many people are living in your apartment, but what their names are. And if there's a different person living there, you can be cited. And they deliberately tried to make their citations higher than any other municipality in the county. So just seeing that confluence of objectives, revenue generation, and enforcing this racialized social order really forced me to think about the role of policing and the role that race plays in how policing has formed and how it's carried out. And I learned also that many of these dynamics were present in some of the agencies I had investigated and hadn't really been attuned to. So that was really important to me. We really tried to capture a lot of that in the findings report. And it was really gratifying when the report was released. We were very concerned at the time that it would be overshadowed by the announcement of that was made the same day that there would be no criminal charges against Darren Wilson. And certainly that was an important announcement. It was important for people to know that, but I didn't want what we found to sort of be lost in that discussion. And we were very pleased that it wasn't, that people were really focused on what we found and this idea and how brutal that could become, because of course, what first drew the nation's and the world's eyes to Ferguson was the response, the militaristic response to individuals who were just protesting their treatment. And we helped explain why people were so justified in protesting their treatment, not just the treatment of Michael Brown, but the treatment of the entire community for so many years. And so that was really gratifying. And then very quickly, we negotiated a consent decree. The city sat with us and negotiated a consent decree for months, and then at the last minute tried to pull out of the consent decree, and we had to file a lawsuit against them and litigate for a few weeks or months. And then they eventually capitulated and the consent decree was entered, and it's being carried out there. And there have been some dramatic changes there, but you know, the fundamental structure of policing is in many respects the same there. I don't think it's as abusive or harmful, but they haven't sort of changed their views on what policing should be, I don't think, as far as I can tell. At least many people in the city leadership have not. But what was really, I think, disappointing to me is for a moment, after the Ferguson report was released, I felt that the world understood the role that race plays in policing and that other parts of cities play in policing, and that we need to really focus on this broader, look more broadly at what's happening in policing. And that dissipated pretty quickly. Donald Trump was elected, and it seemed like we had really, you really wondered what you had achieved. And then I really saw after George Floyd was murdered and the international protests that rose up after that, that allowed me to see, and I think this was really a broader lesson for me, it allowed me to see that all the work that had been done by activists and advocates before, during, and after Ferguson, it had created the groundwork, or you know, the foundation, so that when George Floyd was murdered, you didn't have to start from zero. People already had a bit more familiarity, sophistication about these issues, and were able to learn more from the George Floyd incident than they would have learned if they hadn't been educated by all the work of activists and advocates after Ferguson and before George Floyd. So that actually made me feel a little bit better about the work overall, a reminder that you do the work today, but you may not see the outcomes or the fruits of that work for years. But you do it and you hope that it's there and it will eventually bear fruit.
Yeah, that's a great reminder that, you know, 2020 wasn't this spontaneous combustion, but it was, you know, it was sort of shepherded along through points in the road like Ferguson that, you know, led to this growing consciousness among the public. I want to dwell a bit on some of the patterns of abuse, the types of abuse, constitutional violations, racial discrimination that you've noticed in some of your investigations and that are captured so well in the findings of these reports. In your Lawfare piece, you speak a lot about the Minneapolis and Louisville reports. You drill down on some specific trends, I think. So, for example, the pretext stops, First Amendment violations, in addition to, you know, racially motivated abuses and searches of other kinds. You talk about how the findings that these reports have are chilling, in part because of their frequency, but also how casually that these can occur. So I was hoping you might just drill down on a few of these common abuses that you've seen over the years.
So I think, again, people are a lot more sophisticated about the kinds of abuses. You know, people know, I mean, the idea that people know what you are talking about when you mentioned what a pretext stop or qualified immunity, for example, is, you know, 5 years ago, I would just not have believed you if you had told me that would ever happen. So I'm really grateful for people's willingness. I think all of us are, for people's willingness to sort of engage on these issues and learn just a little bit about what's happening in policing. And so a lot of this, I think people know more than they used to. But what struck me about both the Louisville and the Minneapolis report, more than anything else, was the department's willingness to state clearly that even where police are operating pursuant to law, the law is such that it facilitates violations of individuals' rights. And the pretext stop is the perfect example of that. And they talk about it in both reports that, yes, the Supreme Court has said that you may stop someone for one reason, even though your actual motivation to stop them is a different reason. And as long as that the reason you stop them is in fact a violation, that's reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. But both reports talked about how easy it is for officers to use that Fourth Amendment shield to stop people for reasons that have nothing to do with public safety, have everything to do with their own stereotypes or biases, or just, you know, if there happen to be an officer who's a bully, whatever they want for any reason that they'd like. And I think the fact that DOJ was willing in two findings reports to actually call that out and to say, you know, you need, even though our charge is to ensure that policing is constitutional and lawful, we're here to tell you that you need to do more than just tell your officers to abide by the law. Because if that's all you're telling them to do, it leaves the door open for a lot of harmful behavior and a lot of behavior that will cross that line from legal to illegal. And that idea is a really important one, not only to recognize in the context of stops or searches based on pretext, but in the use of force. Use of force need just be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And the way that's been interpreted is so generous to officers that it really allows a lot of force that is absolutely unnecessary, isn't needed to protect anyone, and is incredibly harmful. And so I think that really sets us off on a better path to actually change policing in a way that will result in overall less harm, and where the changes that you do make will be more sustainable.
Earlier in the conversation, and again in your Lawfare piece, you, as I mentioned, you trace really well the evolution of pattern or practice investigations throughout at least the past three administrations. And if I'm representing your argument correctly, the Biden administration seems to reflect perhaps a sort of paradigm shift or a broader reckoning with ideas of public safety. Could you speak a bit more about that? I'm thinking also of a trend that you mentioned that there's a recognition, for example, that internal accountability mechanisms have fallen short and that we need to protect external ones. But there was something, I think, in reading your piece that, for anyone who is, you know, wanting significant police reform, that maybe there's something to be hopeful about as these pattern or practice investigations in the Biden administration increase in frequency.
I thought that was actually, I think this is the most important thing about both of those reports and about the potential shift that we see in the Civil Rights Division in these investigations. And that is that there is an acknowledgement that in order to have the kind of policing that we want, and by the kind of policing we want, I mean the kind of policing that is effective at protecting people and that doesn't violate people's rights routinely, you do need to have a broader public safety response. And it was so important for DOJ to take that step forward and not let itself get mired in, you know, this sort of ridiculous political back and forth. You know, unless you say you're 100% for police, then you're obviously you want to defund them and abolish the police. And just for them to recognize that you can believe that there is a role for police to play in protecting public safety, but also believe that we need to bring in other public and private actors to play a role in public safety, because right now the police are taking too central a role and taking up too much of that responsibility. And that is the source of a lot of the ineffectiveness as well as a lot of the constitutional violations that we're seeing. And the way that those two reports talked about that, and the framing that they used was to focus on the response to persons in behavioral health crisis. People who are in mental health crisis, or perhaps are having a bad reaction because of a drug overdose or whatever, they're having a response, but it is a public health issue, a mental health issue, not so much a criminal issue. And we just send police. You know, we don't send police when someone is having a heart attack, but when they're having a mental health crisis, as opposed to a physical crisis, we send police. And so their recognition that that's what was happening in these jurisdictions, and that was resulting in a pattern of violations, and that the city, and that violated not only the Constitution, but the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that the answer to that is to broaden out your public safety response so that you have someone to send to those calls rather than simply police. Well, that was something we had never done in the investigations during the Obama administration. The closest we got was probably the Baltimore investigation. But if you look at that findings report, it's really still talking about doing all that work through the police department, through the crisis intervention response of police officers. These two reports, for the first time, talk about bringing that response outside of the police department and having other city actors respond to those sorts of calls. And that sort of more expansive thinking about what public safety requires, that is how we get to the next level where we have more effective public safety and policing that doesn't result in violations as frequently as it does now.
Yeah, I'm curious your thoughts on how then we translate that into real change, I guess, at the community level. So, you know, for example, I think some activists and community members might be forgiven in saying, this is great, you know, these admissions are great. The Justice Department is finally saying the quiet part out loud or coming around to things that, you know, community members have known. And yet mostly Black and brown people are still being murdered at the hands of police. These abuses persist in certain cities and communities. So how do we close that gap? Before you answer, I realize I'm asking you to solve an immense societal problem. So you can feel free to shut me down here. But I guess I'm just curious of your response to some of those criticisms.
No, I tilt at this windmill every day, so that's perfectly fine. You're completely right. It's not like, oh, the DOJ says this, just you have to march through, get a consent decree, and everything will be fixed. I don't think that at all. I've been very clear for a very long time now that, you know, DOJ consent decrees are not going to fix policing on their own regardless. They are one part of the solution, one tool in the toolbox. And one of the things that those the consent decrees need to do is to create a lot of space and opportunity for other advocates and actors to make the change they need to make. DOJ needs to be more cognizant of the potential for it to occupy the field over much and not let enough of that other work take place. And that's one of the things, by the way, that I thought was so encouraging about their focus on First Amendment and the ability of outsiders to have access to information and to record what the police are doing, because that's part of that, you know, creating space for others to do this work. So that's absolutely critical. But I think what's important about DOJ acknowledging what activists and advocates have been saying for a while now, and many police officers too, for that matter, that we need to look beyond police, you know, for our public safety response, is in part that it normalizes it. I've been guilty of calling DOJ pathologically moderate in the past, and that when the pathologically moderate part of this work says, yeah, like this is not radical, this is not, you know, some sort of out there idea, get some other people involved. That, I think, changes the entire conversation and dynamics and allows other people who might be afraid, might not be so certain of whether this actually makes sense, you know, and this, I'm not saying this should be the case either, but it is the case that some people feel safer supporting these sorts of ideas if DOJ has come out and said, yeah, you got to get some behavioral response teams. You can't have police going out to all these things. And we've seen that actually. If you look at polling, this group called the Lake Group did polling of individuals, and they found that where people know that there's an alternative to police, like a behavioral health response, they support it. But when they're not aware that there might be an alternative response, for example, to, you know, neighbor disputes or domestic violence, then they want the police there, right? But when the potential for a response is presented to you, it turns out people are actually pretty open to that response not being the police. So DOJ sort of opening that door and starting to allow us to have that conversation, I think, is really helpful and really important, and hopefully will. And I've talked to people who are doing this work completely separately from government, and they agree that it was useful to have DOJ you know, have these ideas be part of their findings report, because it sort of bolsters the legitimacy of what they've been saying all along.
Now, for this next question, I'm going to ask you to engage in a bit of speculation. So again, feel free to shut me down there if that's not a game you like to play. But I'm curious, you know, of what happens if the next administration comes in. Perhaps it's a Trump administration, perhaps it's another administration who is not so much pro-police as unquestionably pro-police, or, you know, completely uncritical of any, you know, any hard look at police practices. Is there a danger of undoing all this work? I mean, you mentioned, I think you began to answer this question earlier when you were discouraged at developments under the Trump administration, but that actually you were reminded of this growing consciousness, or the groundwork that activists and you know, and your work at with the Ferguson Report played. But what is the danger of just how many steps can be taken back by just the change of administration?
I think there's a proven danger of an administration that is hostile to police reform and or protecting people's civil rights from police abuses. And the department has in the past tried to guard against that. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's important that it be more expansive in the next slew of consent decrees it's about to negotiate. And what I mean by that is, when the second George Bush came in after Clinton, we learned that it wasn't a great thing that a lot of our investigations had been resolved with memoranda of agreement. Those agreements are between the parties, nothing's filed in court. And so you had this new administration come in, and suddenly the plaintiffs, the Civil Rights Division, weren't so keen on enforcing these agreements. So that was part of the reason, you will notice, under the Obama administration, most of those agreements are resolved not through memoranda of agreements or memoranda of understanding. They're resolved through consent decrees. Because among other things, what that does is it involves a judge in that equation. And that judge will remain regardless of a change in administration. And we saw that be very important. We saw, you know, in LA, there was a consent decree, and the Department of Justice under Bush went in and tried to say the consent decree should be ended. And the judge was like, just said, no, of course it shouldn't be ended. It hasn't been implemented yet. We saw the importance. That was sort of the example of why a consent decree was so important. And so we very much, you know, followed that approach during the Obama administration. And that, again, was proven to be very important when we didn't quite get to the consent decree negotiation phase with Chicago, and Jeff Sessions, the AG that came in, immediately dropped it. We did barely get to the consent decree, got the consent decree over the finishing line in Baltimore, and DOJ ordered its attorneys to go in and try to rescind that consent decree. And the judge said, no, I'm not rescinding it. So that was one way that the department has already demonstrated in the past that it recognizes the risk when a new administration comes in and has thought about ways to guard against it. We learned more about what can happen during the Trump administration. And that's one of the reasons I think that I feel so strongly, and perhaps DOJ also recognizes this, about creating that capacity through the consent decrees for others to do that work. So, for example, not only through ensuring that people's First Amendment rights are protected, but also by ensuring that as part of a consent decree, the jurisdiction is required to gather a lot of data about what its police officers are doing, to analyze that data, to make it public, so that individuals far beyond the Department of Justice have access to the information they need to assess what their police department is doing and to challenge it if necessary.
And to bring this conversation back to where we started, what will you be looking for, insofar as you have a window into the process of the ongoing Memphis investigation and then eventually in the report? You know, what are you hoping to see, I guess, in Memphis, and then perhaps also in a broader sense in terms of similar work that the Justice Department might undergo for the remainder of the Biden administration?
I think I'm looking for both process expansion and substance expansion. And by process expansion, I'm thinking of the need to incorporate communities more, not only in the investigation of a department, but also in the implementation of the consent decree. So community groups and advocates are directly involved with assessing, with defining what success is under a consent decree. They get to decide from the outset, how will we know when we have the kind of policing that we want? You know, that is the role that a community should play. That should not be a role. You know, mayors shouldn't decide that. Chiefs shouldn't decide that. communities should decide that. So they should be involved in the beginning for setting up those metrics. You know, how will we know when we've succeeded, and then be involved in assessing whether the department is there. I would love to see that. It is not easy, but it is absolutely the next frontier on process. On substance, I would love to see more of what we saw in the Minneapolis and Louisville letters in terms of thinking more creatively and expansively about a broader public safety response. I was very intrigued to hear Assistant Attorney General Clark say during the announcement of the Memphis investigation that they understood the challenge of fighting violence in Memphis that the city was facing, but they also understood that fighting that kind of crime requires a collaboration of broad groups of community and other actors. And that made me just a bit hopeful that they're actually going to start looking at bringing it really the role that a broader response to even violent crime, so not just mental health, behavioral crises and things like that, but you know, the straight up homicides, gun violence, you know, that can't just be a police response. Can we incorporate some of that response into our consent decrees and really thinking about ways to do that? And also to think about when we do have a police response, how prescriptive can we be to ensure that we have the police response that is what Professor Rachel Harmon calls harm efficient. So we recognize that police have a role to play in preventing violence, but we have to make sure that they play that role in a manner that doesn't cause more harm than good, which is exactly, of course, what we saw Tyree Nichols, you know, made clear that that's what the Scorpion unit was doing. I think that's exactly why DOJ decided to go into Memphis. And so I think it's incumbent upon them to really look at how do we encourage the kind of policing that, yes, seeks to prevent violence, but not in a manner that causes more harm than good.
Well, if the Justice Department is an indicator of the pathologically moderate, as you've suggested in the past, then maybe we can be hopeful that the entire spectrum is moving in a promising direction when it comes to police reform and attitudes on policing. So with that, Christy Lopez, I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for other shows, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.